Welcome, everybody, to Planet SciComm. I'm Jason McDermott, one of the co-hosts. I'm here with Sarah Yeoh and Patrick Fideau. And today we have a really great guest, someone I've worked with for about 15 years, Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist currently at the International Vaccine Center in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. That's Canada, for those that don't know. And she has worked in on multiple different viruses. Most notably in the recent past, has been a very loud and truthful voice for SARS-CoV-2 during the pandemic. COVID.
The virus is
SARS-CoV-2.
actually called SARS coronavirus
Right.
2, though.
That's right. And we're virologists here. Well, I'm a pretend virologist.
I am
She's worked
not a
on
I'm not
many.
a virologist.
But you're microbiologist, and Jason is virology highly adjacent.
Yes, I am a virology adjacent. And she's worked on many other viruses of notable newsworthiness, let's say, in some cases, MERS, Ebola, influenza of multiple different varieties, including the bad ones, and others. So, welcome, Angie.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason. And it's great to see you again, as always.
Yeah, definitely. Great to see you too. So I mentioned you had a voice in the pandemic, and that voice came, I don't know if it's primarily through Twitter, but you have like 500,000 followers now. And one of the things that I noted and really appreciated is during all the craziness, and especially not like in the first few months, but it was like that 6 month onward where the voices of misinformation and conspiracy theories and all kinds of stuff came up, is that there were a few voices on Twitter which I could look to and say, thank God there are people who have a clear insight. And I knew from the work that we'd done previously, and I knew from, the kinds of things that you were tweeting about or Xing about. I don't even know what to call it now.
Tweeting is fine. I still call it
Tweeting.
Twitter. I'm old
Yeah.
school.
Me too. But you and I would say a couple others really had a I felt took a role that was super important, and it kept me in part sane that there were these voices, because I was saying this to my friends and family and kind of in a very kind of local way, and then to have it said at a much larger scale, I thought was really, really important. And I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that. I think it's an interesting topic for science communication because you're very much a scientist. You actually have a you kind of have a science communication pedigree a bit because you're in Vincent's lab, and I didn't realize that until I went and looked at your CV, and I was like, oh. And Vincent, how do you pronounce his last name? Roncalo?
Rack and yellow.
Racaniello. Wow. Okay. Racaniello is a notable name in virology podcasting. So he runs a virology podcast and does other kinds of science. Anyway, I'll let you answer because I've rambled on now.
No worries. And this is like a thing I ramble about a lot too, just because I didn't want to play that role during the pandemic. And some of it was kind of due to my personal circumstances. So at the beginning of the pandemic, I was based at Columbia University at the Mailman School of Public Health. But my family actually lived in Seattle or in the Seattle area. And that was partly because my younger son was still in high school. And so we didn't want him to have to move and to pick which parent he was going to live with, since my husband's ex-wife lives in the Seattle area as well. And so I was commuting back and forth for 4 years. Actually, after I left the University of Washington and moved to Columbia, I was on United Airlines a
Wow,
lot. I still have
that's
one case status, so
Wow.
But my husband, you know, needed to stay there. And so I needed to be in New York. And in March of 2020, I had to make a choice. And at that point, you know, there was, when I was in New York, I had been doing a lot of television media and stuff, just because I was there and it was convenient. And I had a little bit of media experience from before. So as you know, when I was working on Ebola, I had a very high profile paper come out in Science in 2014 during the West African epidemic. And so I was in the media a little bit for that. I had a number of interviews, and one of my best friends from college, and this is, we can talk about this later, but this is the source of a bunch of different conspiracy theories about me. One of my friends owns a PR company that she started, and her specialty is like booking people on television or radio media. So she basically provides her services to me for free and offered to connect some of her colleagues in the TV business with me. And so I had been doing a little bit of that at the beginning of the pandemic, which was mostly like going on, you know, like the 7 a.m. Ali Velshi show on MSNBC and being like, yeah, we don't really know that much right now.
Right.
But here's what we know about SARS-1. Here's what we know about MERS. Like, here's what we know about coronaviruses. And there were some in those early days, like there were so many questions. It's like, well, do masks work too?
Right.
You know, is there a vaccine? Like all these questions that are so broad, like, but you have to really learn how to say, like, I don't know, in a way that still conveys some kind of information to people, but it has to be accurate and useful.
Right.
And then March happened. So I was in Seattle. I had come out for a pre-planned trip to Hawaii, actually, with my parents and my husband. And we got back from Hawaii. I was supposed to fly back to New York, and my husband was supposed to go to India for work, and I was going to go with him and meet him there, leaving from New York. And it was the day before I was supposed to fly back. And I just said, you know what? I think I'm going to have to make a choice right now. If I'm going to go back to New York, there's the possibility I'm going to get stuck in New York indefinitely, like by myself. And people were talking about shutting down the universities and stuff. And
yeah,
we did have a BSL-3 lab at Columbia, but it was tiny. It's like the size of my bedroom closet. It's not the type of facility that you can really do meaningful work in. And I just thought about it. And I was like, the only reason I would go back to New York is if like I can actually do something in a lab that could contribute. And right now in New York, it's clear that the way that you can contribute is by being a healthcare provider, by working at the hospital that's across the street from my work, but I don't do that. So it's either that or stay indefinitely with my family. And that was a no-brainer. So I just decided to stay in Seattle, and I actually never went back to New York until it was time to pack up my apartment and move out because I was no longer going to live or work there. And I'm stuck in Seattle and I didn't have that much to do. And I talked to some of my old colleagues at UW and offered, you know, if you need me to come like do PCRs, because if you recall, at the end of February, the Seattle flu study did some incredible work. Trevor Bedford, Alex Grenier, like and Helen. Oh, my gosh. Why am I blanking on her last name? Helen Chu, I think. Did this incredible work where they just said, you know what, we're not asking for permission for diagnostics. We're just going to sequence this stuff. And they found that the virus had been circulating undetected in the Seattle area for 3 to 6 weeks. And I'll never forget, I was actually on my way to MSNBC at 30 Rock the day that Trevor Bedford tweeted about that. I read it in the car, like on the way to go be on MSNBC at like, it was like 6 in the morning on a Sunday, but I saw Trevor's tweet that said, you know, we've found these sequences. They're not associated with known cases and they've probably been circulating for 3 to 6 weeks. And that was the moment for me that I was like, can I swear? I was like, oh shit. this is really bad. And this went from being a containable situation to one that's not. And so I was trying to figure out how to do this. So I'd offered to help with that, but they don't need my help. I also don't work there anymore, so I'd have to do all the safety lab training and stuff all over again. Pardon me. So I just said, well, I'm going to like read papers and I'm going to talk to the press if they need me, because people really need good, like reliable information. And this stuff is really complicated. And I'm just going to talk about it on like social media. And at the time, it's funny that you say like you miss Twitter, because I do too. And like yeah. Twitter in 2020 was a very different place. Oh my gosh, place.
Very different.
It was so useful. Like I could see, yeah. And I mean, many of the people I know, they're my colleagues, but Twitter's like a great way for them to just say, hey, everybody, like this is the latest thing that I'm thinking about or that I'm working on. Rather, it's so much easier and broad than like all of your colleagues or whatever. And it's just a way also to talk directly to the public. So it was so helpful, like to sort through all this stuff. But at the time also, preprints have been around for longer than since 2020. But this was the first epidemic I can think of where there was really like treating preprints like they were papers. And the media yeah. was doing, at the beginning of February, I remember there was stuff about the snake, you know, the dumb codon usage analysis this group yeah. did, where they said, oh, it probably came from snakes, heavily flawed.
Yeah. We're talking about this idea of sort of preprints or, right? Because it yeah. isn't peer reviewed in any way. And,
no.
and it's sort of like I'm tweeting the thing I just found in my lab that I haven't published, that hasn't undergone any kind of peer review. And so I'm pretty interested in that.
Yeah. So that's one kind of tweet that, and those can be good and bad. Like there was an example of a colleague who tweeted out a completely sort of unvetted phylogenetic tree that they had made like on the fly early on in the pandemic that I don't remember exactly what the point was, but it had to do with the origins of the virus. And people don't know always how to interpret that kind of thing. And also
yeah.
you need to put that kind of stuff out there with the appropriate caveats. And I think preprints are a more formal mechanism for doing this. But the problem was that, and same with actual tweets of unpublished data, is that sometimes the media would pick it up mm-hmm. and they would treat it as if it had gone through peer review, as if it was, you know, completely consensus, agreed upon, like scientific fact, and the reporting would go from there. And like in a time when things are changing so rapidly, which I've realized the public really struggles to grasp.
Definitely.
The sort of mm-hmm. changing nature of science and the changing nature of the evidence base. And really the fundamental aspect of science that you're actually trying to change your mind. You're trying to test a hypothesis right. and prove it wrong if you're a good scientist. And when you can't prove it wrong anymore, that's when you know that something is actually probably factual. But people don't have this kind of context. And so for me, one of the things I thought I could be most helpful with, in addition to trying to answer some of these questions in more traditional media outlets, just because I was sitting at home all day and like you can only write so many grant applications and try to work on so many outstanding papers, was to really try to help people process the information and take from it what they need to know to like make the time a little bit less scary and help keep themselves and their families a little more safe. And I mean, that's hard to do when like you don't really know anything. You know, people love to come back and bring up old tweets where I, you know, at the beginning or the end of January, at one point, people love this one. I said to everybody, get your flu shot because you're at a much higher risk of getting flu than you are NCOV-2019, which was the name of the virus at the time. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know what, that was true at the time yep. based on the information right. that I had. At the time, on January 26th, 2020, there were probably fewer than 10 cases of SARS-2 in the U.S. And for most people, that advice would make sense. of course, then a month later, right, when I saw the data on the spread, the undetected community spread in Seattle, I would not have made that same recommendation. But people to this day, there's a very prominent New York Times columnist who really doesn't like me very much. And she's constantly subtweeting me about this, that, oh, some people, some virologists told people to get flu shots when they should have been preparing for a pandemic.
Right, right. It's
How do you prepare for it? Go buy some toilet paper? Like, I mean, what are you actually supposed to do? So it's really hard, and I haven't gotten it all right at all. I've gotten many things wrong, but, you know, that's really kind of what I was trying to do, partly because I didn't have anything else to do. And more now, even though I have like the most amazing, I have access to the most amazing containment lab I've ever worked in. So now in a pandemic, I'll be doing something very different. I'll probably still be tweeting though, and talking to the press. And that's what I have been doing for the last couple of weeks with H5N1,
right,
and cattle. But, you know, I'll also be working. But I do think that the communication stuff, even though it wasn't planned, is really, really important for all the reasons that you mentioned in the introduction, Jason. Like it, and I see it now as actually part of my job with a platform like mine, which, you know, some people would really love to have this platform, and we'll talk about it, I'm sure, maybe in a little bit, but it's both a privilege and it's a serious, I don't want to say it's a blessing and a curse. It's not really a curse, but it's not always, it doesn't feel like a privilege as much as it probably should.
Oh.
But I recognize how important it is. And so for that reason, I've started to incorporate it as just thinking about it as part of my job.
So building on that, you mentioned that this was something that started out of an abundance of time at the beginning of the pandemic. Well, now you're working in a very nice facility, as you just mentioned, and are doing lots of other stuff, and yet continue to tweet. How has your approach to tweeting changed through the pandemic to what could be the beginning of a new set of outbreaks?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one that I probably could spend it all day answering. So I'll try to be quick about it. But it's changed a lot, and not just for that reason. I mean, I think some of it's changed because of the changing nature of the platform itself. Like many of you, and like Jason was saying, I've backed off of Twitter a lot. Some of that's been a function of time. Some of it has been the fact that the new ownership of Twitter seems to have zero problem with letting Nazis and assorted other violent bigots just run loose on the platform. And then the other thing is really sort of the unintended consequences. And it's great that Jason brought up Vincent Racaniello, my PhD mentor, because I remember he started his podcast, This Week in Virology, when I was still a graduate student. And now he's done like thousands of episodes, but I was on like TWIV number 6. Because at first he was doing it with just like the people in his lab.
Right.
And you know, he and I had a very different sort of philosophy about it. I'm kind of more just off the cuff when using social media or when talking like outside of a formal sort of laboratory setting. And Vincent is very focused on teaching, and that's why I think his podcast is extremely successful, because he doesn't dumb things down or make euphemisms for complex concepts in virology, but he explains them in plain language. And so I really did learn a lot from him, but you know, he uses social media in a very different way than I do. And the way that I use social media, the changes in Twitter and the attention that I got have been actually really challenging to deal with emotionally to a certain degree, because there's a lot of people who really
totally
don't like
see
me.
That.
And I thought that I had a really thick skin. And I saw Vincent last year at the nidovirus meeting in Montreux, Switzerland, and somebody was coming up to both of us, like these students, and they were oh my God, like queen of Twitter and like the king of virology and Twiv, like, can we all take a picture and stuff? And somebody had asked both of us, like, you know, how did you guys do it? Like, how did you build your platforms or whatever? And I said something like, it was kind of by accident. And Vincent was like, and I was like, be careful, you know, like with how you do it, if that's what you do want to do, if you want to get into communications, you have to make sure that you're protecting yourself. And Vincent's like, I've known you for 20 years, 25 years. He's like, you've always been like the kind of center of attention. And it's true. I'm super extroverted. I do like to be like in charge and kind of the one talking about things. But not so much with this, like, because it has really taken a toll on me emotionally. And I just told Vincent, I'm like, be careful what you wish for, you know, you think that like you'd be really good at this. And I think that I am really good at the communications part of it, but you don't always think about what some of the unintended consequences are going to be for that. And so, there are days when I wish that I could just use Twitter the way that I used to when I had like 200 followers, where I could just engage in like chats with people. Yeah. And now a lot of my thinking about Twitter, I mean, it's really evolved to the point where I think about it in terms of engagement. Like, do I want to engage with this account where it's potentially going to draw more attention to the misinformation or the hateful stuff that they're saying? Because if I respond, the way that the Twitter algorithm works, or the X algorithm or whatever, is that I might inadvertently end up amplifying accounts that I think should not be amplified. So I have to be really careful about it. Also, just Twitter rewards people for creating drama and conflict. And some people, I think, live for it. Like, you know, and every once in a while, I have to say, there's nothing like a good old Twitter fight when you feel like you're the one who's winning. At the same time, it also really sucks to be at the bottom of a Twitter dog pile. And especially if there's not really a good reason for you to be at the bottom, because people are saying stuff about you that's not true, or like the flu shot thing. And it actually just really, it can be really demoralizing just to see over and over again people saying horrible things about you. And like, not only about you as a scientist or you as a communicator, but you as a human being. Like, people have criticized what kind of mother I am. People have criticized whether I'm a mother at all, because I have stepkids and not like biological children. People have criticized like what kind of a spouse I am, like speculated on my marriage. All kinds of stuff about my personal life. So I've really also tried, my husband's on Twitter, my father's on Twitter. I tried never to tag them. I have my Instagram and Facebook accounts locked down, because that's where I post like pictures of my family. The only thing I'll post now are pictures of my dogs and pictures of the exteriors or interiors of my house where you couldn't figure out where my house is.
Wow.
And I just never had to think about that kind of stuff before. You know, I like basic security, my own like emotional well-being, like the well-being and security of the people that I love and care about. Like, I always have to think a lot more about what I'm going to post rather than having the freedom to just engage in a discussion. And I really miss that.
I wonder too, honestly, like a lot of the things that you're saying, I wonder how they would be different if you were not female.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, one of the most interesting things I thought about the origins of SARS coronavirus 2, which is an area of research that I'm involved in, and boy, that is the absolute worst topic like to discuss on Twitter. Because there's, you know, to make a very long story short, there are some people who are really determined to believe that it was a so-called lab leak. The research that me and my colleagues have done has taken multiple threads of evidence, phylogenetic evidence, geographical evidence, virological evidence, genomic evidence, kind of put it all together, and as well as circumstantial and administrative and documentary evidence, put it all together to conclude that the only thing that fits with the evidence that we have is that the virus emerged through the wildlife trade at the Huanan Seafood Market, which was a very large wet market where there were multiple vendors. It's one of four markets in Wuhan that was selling live wildlife animals. A lot of markets sell live animals like chickens and things like that. This one was also selling palm civets and raccoon dogs and foxes and minks and various animals that customers would buy, and they extremely fresh, like they'd be slaughtered and butchered like right on demand for the customer. And we think that's how this emerged. Well, this is a terrible topic of discussion on Twitter. And I've been called like the minister of propaganda for the Zoonotti, which is what they call us.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's Zoo Crew is another term, but I prefer Zoonotti.
Zoonotti has a more elegant sound to it.
Yeah, I don't think I understand. What do they mean by
that? They mean like the Illuminati, except for pro-zoonosis.
Oh, so zoonosis for us.
For SARS-2, like it spilled over from an animal into humans.
Oh, okay.
But they think that didn't happen. They think that we're all a bunch of corrupt virologists and, sort of these shady characters who are all working for Tony Fauci. I mean, I made a very long story very short. There's all kinds of elements and rabbit holes you can go down and sort of lab leak lore. But basically the point is that we're all a bunch of corrupt virologists. We all we all get off doing gain of function research for no reason because it's incredibly dangerous. And we are maybe making bioweapons, and everything that we're doing is part of an elaborate cover up to hide the fact that this was a lab leak from all of our like reckless, extremely evil, yet also not very competent virology work that we're doing and that we're eventually going to destroy the world with. Well, anyways,
that
I mean, this is
a very elaborate conspiracy theory. Yes. I'm sure there are many deeper levels to that conspiracy theory, but.
Oh God, so many.
It just seems like that none of these people have ever done project management. Getting like five people to work together is hard. Getting a worldwide cadre of virologists and politicians to work together, good luck.
Well, honestly, I mean,
not only that, from the US government and the military science wing of the PLA and the Communist Party of China. It's so absurd, but yeah.
I mean, it is interesting. There are easier ways, I think, to take over world domination. There's easier ways.
Possibly
through social media, but that's just a hypothesis.
You mean then releasing a virus that has at best 3% case fatality rate?
Great. You would think there are more efficient ways if one was truly, anyway.
Come on. These people clearly never watch Pinky and the Brain. There's other opportunities.
I never watch Pinky and the Brain.
Every afternoon, there are other opportunities, Patrick.
It
is interesting because you wouldn't get, I think a lot of the comments you mentioned, you probably wouldn't get if you weren't a woman.
That's where I was going with all of this. So there are very few women who are involved in this research and who are involved in this discussion. There's me. There's Marianne Koopmans, who is the director of the Viroscience Group at Erasmus Medical Center. She's one of the world's most accomplished virologists. She was on the WHO mission to China in 2021. And there is Flo DeBar, who is a computational theoretical evolutionary biologist from France. And then there's Gigi Granval, who is a biosecurity expert at Johns Hopkins University. Mm-hmm. And Saskia Popescu, who is a biosecurity biodefense person at the University of Maryland. But other than that, there's not a lot of women in the Zoonotti. And I don't think that's a coincidence because I've noticed this is like mainstream, right? So two of our senior authors, Christian Anderson and Bob Gary, were dragged in front of the select subcommittee for the COVID-19 pandemic last summer and grilled by Marjorie Taylor Greene and Jim Jordan about
wonderful.
You think this was gain of function research and all this stuff. And they get called all the time. Like, so Christian and Bob and Mike Warby, who's been another leader in our group, and all the other wonderful men that like I work with, they get called corrupt, evil, you know, they're cynical and they're out to, they don't care like who they destroy. As long as they are getting grant money from Tony Fauci, they'll do whatever he wants, including help the Chinese make terrible bioweapons, apparently, or, you know, try to cover up their lab leaks and all this stuff, which, as Patrick, you pointed out, would require a conspiracy of literally thousands of people in multiple countries. Mm-hmm. It's not very plausible, but I get called that stuff too, except on top of that, I get told that I'm old, right. I'm ugly, I'm fat, I'm all of these different things. And like they have literally tried to have a hashtag, like hashtag fat Angie trend on Twitter. It never has, wow. But I mean, it's, so much about it is about my personal life, my appearance, how attractive I am or not. And very little about it is about my science as much as it is. I mean, that's just a given, I guess, a baseline that I'm a bad scientist and I'm evil. But on top of that, I'm right. also
yes, because
undesirable
the men,
for all of these other gender-coded reasons.
Yeah, and the men don't get comments about how bad like a parent they might be or a spouse right. they might be or what they're wow. wearing. And this is true across the board, I think, for women in all positions of power. I actually saved and you know, since we're talking sort of implicitly about political sort of ideologies, right? And it's across the aisle. So I have a great tweet from Fox News about, and I don't remember which senator it was, but it was a picture of her shoes. Right. And it was a comment about her shoes in this Fox News tweet, which you would never see about a man. Right. And so there's something,
never.
You know, yeah, cross cutting that it is OK to say something about what women are wearing, how women are as human beings or as parents or spouses. But you don't see that in the media around
yeah.
men, which is very interesting and probably has to do with sort of stereotypes, right, obviously around women. And I think one of the other reasons there aren't that many women that are in the media is partly because we also still have a very big gender disparity. Probability-wise, there just aren't as many women scientists.
Yeah, there aren't. And, you know, that's not true, though, in microbiology.
Oh,
I mean, there's way more female PhDs than there are at least new PhDs. There are more PhDs awarded to women than men within at least microbiology and virology. And the numbers are getting, I mean, at the PhD award level.
Right.
Of course, as
right.
you go up
yeah.
the ladder,
there's fewer
right. and fewer professors, assistant right. professors, tenured professors. If you throw race and ethnicity in there, you know, then you're going to have fewer still. You're going to have fewer still, for example, Black women. Who are tenured professors, who are university administrators, who are at those higher levels. And that is a real problem that I think is across the board. It's certainly not just affecting microbiology, but
sure.
this is one of the reasons for that. And it's exactly as you said, Sarah, it's that it is acceptable. It is considered still acceptable, even in a professional realm, to have different standards for how women and men should behave, should look, and what constitutes professionalism or expertise between the two genders. And it's infuriating, but
sure, yeah.
it's also incredibly demoralizing. And I have to say, you know, one person calling me fat Angie is fine, like whatever. But, and I did, like many people, put on a little extra weight during the pandemic, but having to hear that over and over again.
Oh my gosh.
I'm glad I did it, but I've lost 70 pounds in the last year thanks to Ozempic. And
there
are other reasons why that's great for me. But I'd be lying if I said that some of it wasn't I just need to change this because I'm tired of people calling me Fat Angie. And that's just one example, but I realized also that, and I don't feel the need to go on, it's not a secret that I like took Ozempic and lost a lot of weight, but I don't need to go on Twitter and talk about it because people are still going to call me Fat Angie. And now I weigh 125
pounds.
They're
going to find
pounds.
Something else that's wrong, right? They're just going to find something else to critique, I think.
And they, you know, they will criticize the fact that I even used Ozempic, or they'll criticize the fact that I get Botox, or they'll criticize the fact that I color my hair or whatever. It's like there's no way that you can actually win.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that when I was thinking about kind of discussion topics and stuff, I was thinking more in general about like the toll of having such a public voice. But I think we've gone over that. It's really not surprising, still disheartening. And I think you've put a more human face on the kinds of things that I know are happening, but it's like, well, especially as a male, I just don't have the same perception. And I wanted to, one thing, you know, I'm a computational biologist and we're fairly informal. And I, at one point was remarking to a female colleague, I was like, you know, nobody cares what I wear around the office. I can wear shorts and flip flops. And their response, their good friend, their response was like, that's not how it is for us. We are not. And I started to look around and I'm like, you know what? All of the women I work with are better dressed than I am. Why is that? And it's because I don't have the same kinds of stuff coming at me. And in our professional environment is very tame. It's a very, very tame version of that. But that is still like, I think, an emblematic of that larger problem.
So Mark Zuckerberg, right, can go to work in a hoodie.
Jeez, right.
I tried that for a semester. Didn't go over that well.
Yeah, and you know, I go to work sometimes. Well, I never wear a hoodie, but I've got like dress yoga pants and things like that. And I'll go to work sometimes when I know I don't have any media and I have to go into the containment lab. Because if I go into the containment lab, it means automatically I'm taking a shower because I have to shower on my way out of the containment lab. And I ended up having to buy, I can actually deduct makeup from my taxes because part of my job is going on TV. And so I have a whole second set of like makeup brushes, like hair styling stuff, like all kinds of crap at work. Because what if there's like, somebody needs to interview me about something and I can fit it into my schedule. And even though usually like media interviews are like a half hour of talking for like a 5 minute clip, especially here in Canada, my favorite is that I was talking to one of my colleagues about this. CBC will ask for an interview about something, you know, vaccination, and you'll spend 30 minutes, 45 minutes going over all the nuances with, and then they show it on the National, which is like the Canadian like nightly news. And it's like a 5 second clip of me being like, make sure you get vaccinated. And it's like, at least they got the important part in there. But, you know, it's not the end of the world if I go on TV with no makeup on, but it's just happened enough that I don't want to deal with the shit that I get for it if I go on TV without makeup on.
Right.
So I just, it's something that I've had to incorporate into my work routine. And I try not to think about it too much because if I do, I really feel resentful about it.
This was something that got brought up a while back in my career. Colleagues could not use their first name if they were women and get respect.
Oh, interesting.
Whereas I could be Patrick and I would still get respect. And I think once the curtain got pulled back on my own incredible privilege in that regard, you can't unsee it. I wonder if anybody could speak to whether this is becoming more talked about, more known, more visible in younger generations of scientists and communicators.
So I will say that, this is actually, I'm really glad you brought this up, because in my experience, to a degree, it's been, it's exactly like you say, but it's sort of the opposite. Like, so I will be on panels and they'll be like, here's Dr. So-and-so, here's Dr. So-and-so, and here's Angie. And that's actually why on my Twitter, I have Dr. Angela Rasmussen. And that's not because I'm like the kind of person, and we all know that there are those kind of people, right? The people who are like, I'm Dr. So-and-so for everything, including like with their friends and stuff. And I'm definitely not like that. Like, we all have PhDs here, so we don't need to be Dr. this and Dr. that. But the reason I have that there is because if I don't put that there, then I'm going to be Angie and somebody else, some other dude, is going to be Dr. whoever. And I tell people all the time, especially like in emails where like they keep calling me over and over again, Dr. Rasmussen, or my students who will like, when they first start in the lab, they're always like, and then I talk to Dr. Rasmussen and I'm like, please call me Angie. Oh my God. But I really only insist on being called Dr. Rasmussen when it's like TV and they're interviewing somebody else. And you know what? I don't care if Vivek Murthy is the Surgeon General. You're going to call him Dr. Murthy, then you're going to call me Dr. Rasmussen, because we both have a professional title that indicates something about our expertise to the audience. And if you're going to use that professional title for a man, then it also needs to be used for me. And I think a lot of women have started to feel this way, because I've heard so many of my female colleagues relate similar stories when it's especially like at conferences, when you're getting introduced as part of the panel. Then it's doctor, 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 woman's first name. And it's, it's just one of those little things that you don't notice until you do. And then you can't stop noticing.
Yep. Or the conference where, you know, you're standing next to a male colleague and the students come up and they're enamored of said male colleague. Right. And they completely ignore you. And you're like, oh, okay.
I kind of like doing that, because now that, especially, you know, thank God I'm not on TV as much as I used to be. People don't always recognize me. And also, I think because I've lost a lot of weight, people don't always know who I am. And so they'll come up and be like, oh, I love you. But like, you know, this happened to me once at a conference with Carlos Del Rio, who is he's the dean of the School of Public Health at Emory. And he's a really big science communicator guy. Wonderful person. And people were coming up and like, I can't believe I'm meeting you and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they're like, who's your friend? And I'm like, show them my conference badge. And they're like, oh my God. And it, like, that's the only time that I really kind of like having like that celebrity status where I'm like, like I have a lot more followers than Carlos does on Twitter. So it's kind of funny when that happens, but I think you're absolutely right, Sarah. Like, I've seen that so many times where it's like, oh my God, like you're just such a famous, like well-respected, eminent man. And wait, who are you again?
And
are you
his friend?
Like administrator? Who's your friend?
Yeah.
Like, wow. Is this your wife? Like, and it's like, what?
So I guess given what you've said, Angie, Dr. Rasmussen, about all of this.
In this crowd, first name is fine, because we're all on a first name basis here.
About your Twitter experience, I guess I can see how it would be discouraging for a scientist, right, who listens and hears about your experience and maybe, you know, is concerned, right? Valid concerns about being in the media and communicating about their work and what they do. Would you do it again?
Probably, because I think to a degree, like some of my media personality, well, I'm like pathologically honest. Honestly, I'm a terrible liar. I'm not good at pretending to be somebody other than who I am. And even though TV Angie isn't what I'm like in real life to talk to, nor is Twitter Angie like I am in real life. I mean, Twitter Angie is a lot more combative. I think I'm actually a pretty nice person, like to just talk to. I feel like I'm pretty normal. I like to think I'm kind of funny. But, you know, TV Angie is very sort of buttoned up and professional. You know, I think those are all like different honest sides of me. Like, they're all very authentic sides of me. And so to be the person that I am, I think I would probably do it again because I do recognize how important it is. And honestly, I just have a hard time keeping my mouth shut, like in the face of bullshit, especially when it's about my profession, especially when it's about stuff that, and you know, pandemic, like everybody is a stakeholder. And if I feel like I can offer something that helps people, then, you know, that's really worth doing. And it's important. And, you know, when you said, Jason, at the beginning that I was one of the people that you look to who was a trusted voice and who helped you, like that is the kind of thing that it's just so gratifying to hear that because that's why I was doing it. And it, you know, that's what makes it worth it to me. But at the same time, Sarah, I really think that everybody has their own sort of bandwidth. And some people, you know, people who are super introverted, people who are extremely private, I think that maybe, you know, going on TV, being out there on Twitter is not the way for them to contribute. Like not everybody has to do this. There's not only one way to do this. And I would say that there's other lots of other media. Like I'm not a good cartoonist at all. So Jason's cartooning is a wonderful way, I think, to reach a lot of people and to get complex. It's another way to get complex concepts out to the public in a way that a lot of people can accept and understand. And it's really one way to meet people where they are. And like stuff like that is wonderful. I mean, I think it's fantastic that in science communication, there's a whole menu of different ways to communicate to choose from. Yeah. And so people don't always need to do so the same way that I have. They don't always need to put themselves out there. I think that there are anonymous accounts on Twitter. There's one person who I've actually met, I know what their name is, but they've had an anonymous account. They're clearly a very accomplished coronavirologist. And I found that their content before I knew who they were has been immensely useful and it still is. Yeah. And they've also been able, they're in Hong Kong, they've also been able to make a lot of really insightful political commentary and tie that to science with a perspective and an expertise that I would never be able to have because of where they are and their own political beliefs and, you know, the situation in Hong Kong and China. And it's just been really remarkable. So I think I would hope that younger people who are thinking about different ways that they could be involved in science communication aren't discouraged because this isn't the only way to do it. And so I think that there's a lot of ways where you can be more protective of your personal space, your personal life, and you know, not put yourself up for all of this that are not the way that I do it, that are very legitimate.
Yeah.
So as you go into that, I wonder, how do you cultivate your SciComm personas? Because you mentioned there was a potentially combative side to Twitter. There's a more potentially, I don't remember the exact word, but a buttoned up version for TV. How do you get there? How did those come about? And how would you suggest that others cultivate such things in their SciComm?
Yeah, for me, it was definitely more organic. Like it's not ever something I've really thought about cultivating. For the media stuff, it's fairly straightforward because that's like what I would do before giving a talk. I had like 5 minutes of media training over the phone with my friend Annie/my PR rep when I was going to go on Fox on Business, I think, with Neil Cavuto to talk about Ebola in like 2014. But that was like, you know, don't ramble. So the opposite of this and talking soundbite. Try not to nod too much. You look like a bobblehead. I still have problems with that one. Things like that. And it's, you know, like stuff like that is like not so much cultivating a persona. It's just like instructions on how to do this one thing. And I think over time, like my sort of different personas have just evolved based on the medium that they're working in. So like Twitter, you know, again, the algorithm incentivizes sort of combat. And so I ended up getting really good at that. Plus, just personally, I really resent anti-vaxxers and the people spreading misinformation and really disinformation, because when it's intentional, it's disinformation. Right. The reason that they're doing that in many cases is not because they're true believers in ivermectin or whatever. The reason that they're doing that is usually they're getting something out of it, either money, power, influence, or all three. And I've become very combative because Twitter is a place where you can call that shit out. And you can really, I think, expose somebody for what they are doing. Not always very well. Like, sometimes they're going to have their own believers, true believers too. And like, try arguing with anti-vaxxers, it's kind of pointless. But you can start to call out some of those conflicts of interest. And so just the medium, I think, has made it so that, you know, on Twitter, that's where I'm going to try to dunk on people who I think are grifters and who are taking advantage of people's, you know, lack of knowledge, people's fear, people's how their lives were disrupted. I mean, to a degree, and we could have a whole other podcast about this, like the pandemic was what anti-vaxxers have been waiting for their whole lives, because they've like been training for it and they are organized. And one of the reasons is that they make a lot of money off of spreading this. They all sell supplements. They're all selling their books.
Oh.
RFK Jr. is running for president. You know, they're getting something out of it. Right. So the rank and file people, like your relatives who send you crazy shit on Facebook, and I have a lot of those.
So, and I'm going to ask you a question about this after, but I'm going to let you finish.
Yeah. Like all those people, like, they are not the ones who are benefiting from it. Right. It's the ones who start that stuff in the first place. And that's what has allowed me to cultivate this, like, put up your dukes, like, let's fight, like, on Twitter. Because I find it abhorrent that you're going to exploit something that has literally killed and is killing millions of people, has disabled millions of others. And you're going to use that as an opportunity to grow your platform and sell people hope and snake oil. That's just not acceptable to me. So that's really how it's worked for me, Patrick. And I think in general, if giving advice about this, I would tell people to be true to yourself in terms of developing like your different sort of media personalities. Because if there's anything that I think people can sniff out also, it's people who are being fake and disingenuous, and just be authentic and true to yourself. And it sort of all falls together naturally, but also know your limits and don't hesitate to log off if it's one of those days. I've learned also that sometimes, you know what, it's just best to not engage and turn off my phone and go take a walk or go for, you know, a
That's so important.
Yeah.
Have a drink, have dinner with my family, like do some, watch TV, like anything. Sometimes it's just good to step away from all of it when you've hit your own limit. Don't forget that you're also human.
Just stay away from the news so you don't see that measles case in Ontario.
Oh God. Well, yeah, I even when I try to stay away from the news, then reporters call me and ask me about it. So I have to go like look at it, but you know, stay away from all the measles cases everywhere. And if you're not up to date on your shot, highly recommend that everybody adults go out and get your measles titers checked.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It's most of, you know, I haven't had an MMR booster since I was like 12. So 30 years ish. And I actually still have quite a high titer. I've had it checked a couple times, so you probably won't need another measles booster, but it's not a bad idea. And obviously it goes without saying, make sure your kids are up to date.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one last question, Angie, before we wrap, given the position you're in, I'm sure I don't know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. If you have family members who are not vaccinated, for example, or won't get vaccinated, how are you dealing with that? Like, how do you manage that?
Yeah, so I do. Not immediate family members. I have a very large extended family. And at this point, you know, sort of how I deal with that, I've learned a long time ago, and actually not even about vaccination, about the person who used to be the president and who's running for president again, as well as sitting at the defendant's table in a criminal trial. You know, that actually caused a huge fracture in our family. And it seems like a lot of the anti-vaccine sentiment is correlated with that. It's unfortunate because you like to think that you'd be able to talk some sense into anybody in your family, but that is not how it's been in my family. And from talking to others, it sounds like that's common. It's common. It's extremely common, more common than not. That's the dominant phenotype, I guess. One thing I've done, and also my dad is the second youngest of nine. So a lot of my family members have been dying lately because a lot of them are old. So I've been to a lot of funerals. And I think in some ways, it's horrible to say this, but I think some of the deaths have reminded people that, you know, we used to actually have a lot of fun together, and this stuff used to not matter as much.
Yeah.
And maybe we should be prioritizing spending time together, even though we disagree on this stuff, and worrying less about like where we're at sort of ideological loggerheads. And so I've been really thinking about it a lot like that lately. And so the answer to that question is, if I know that somebody is anti-vax, is it really the best time at somebody's funeral, like after party? You know how there's always like a buffet at funerals and stuff, or a potluck kind of thing. Is it really the best time to start dragging on somebody?
Have you heard the good word of virology?
Yeah. It's just not the place for it. And I've made it clear that, you know, my family members can come and talk to me anytime if they have any questions, if they have any concerns. But I'm just, you know, that I have to meet them where they are, and I have to accept that even people I love and care about my own family are not always going to agree with me on this stuff. And ultimately, it's a free country. I believe that people should have bodily autonomy. And if I believe that every woman should be able to have access to birth control and abortion on demand, I also unfortunately have to believe that people shouldn't be forced to be vaccinated, and it's their choice. And the only way to convince people that they should get vaccinated and to make the choice that I hope that they make is to allow them the space and the grace to come to me about it when they're ready, or not, or, you know, talk to whoever they think is a trusted source if they have questions about this. But I've realized that that's the kind of thing that I just can't force. And I mean, maybe this is a good note to end on, but a big part of being okay with some of this stuff is to, it's almost like the alcoholic serenity prayer, to have like, to have the grace to accept that you're not going to be able to make a difference in every case, and to just learn how to be okay with that and to accept that and to be open to it if people come to you in the future. But you can't force it, because if you do force it, you're probably going to make certain that those people never want to be vaccinated and are never going to listen to any of it.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for spending your Sunday morning with us, Angie. And I really hope we have you on the show again. And I'm really hoping that it's not post H5N1 pandemic that we have you.
Please don't say that, Jason.
I really hope so, too. The good news is for that, it's not looking like that yet. But of course, the future is uncertain. The bad news on that is that we still don't have any idea how broad the scale of the epidemic is in U.S. cows. And we don't know if it's in other countries yet. And it's not that that's so surprising that flu can infect cows. We've actually known that H5 can infect cows since 2007 when Martin Baer experimentally infected some. But we didn't realize that they would be able to transmit to each other so efficiently. And there's just millions of cows. And lots and lots and lots of people who interact with those cows all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't want to say like it's impossible to have an H5N1 pandemic, because I don't know that it is impossible. But the good news is the viruses that are circulating in the cows right now are not likely to be transmitted efficiently from human to human, at least as far as we know, and they haven't been so far. So that's good. But yes, I agree. I strongly hope that our next conversation is not about the ongoing H5N1 pandemic.
Yeah.
We'll just say it. But thank you very much. And until next time, this has been Planet SciComm.
That sounds wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Yes. And before we go, actually, thank you so much for sharing honestly about your experiences in the media, because you have been in the media a lot. And hearing the very real personal side of it, I think, is valuable from a science communication perspective. So thank you very much.
Definitely.
Well, thank you for asking me about it, because people actually don't ask me about it very much. And I think people ask me a lot, like, how did you do this? Like, how could somebody who wants to do this do it? And it's like, I think, you know, I actually don't know, because like I wasn't planning to like have a huge Twitter following, and it's weird. Like, I just think of myself still as Angie, not as like some kind of company. So it's really, it's a weird place to be. But I don't know. I don't have really very good advice for people, other than like, you have to think about the bad part of it too, like, because it really does like end up affecting you a lot. And you know, if you think it's going to be just like, oh, it would be so awesome to be on TV all the time, actually no, it's exhausting. Like I spent so many days like in this little fake like office nook that we made in my house in Seattle, like with a blazer on and a full face of makeup, and then like joggers underneath.
Yeah,
like it was so ridiculous. Or I'd like take naps on the couch with my dog, and then like get up and have 10 minutes to like put makeup on, and then pretend like I've been working all day on like sequence analysis or something. And it's bizarre. And I never get asked about that stuff. So I'm super glad to talk about it, and I'll happily come and talk with you guys anytime. The time just flew by. I know you got to go, Sarah, but thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Yeah. Thank you. Until next time.